Would you pray with me, please? Let's pray. Lord, even as we sit before the reading of this extraordinary story, and even as we reflect on it now, we ask you to give us ears to hear and eyes to see. And we know that this requires a miracle of your grace, your power working among us. And so we ask for that miracle now in the name of Jesus. Amen. The all-important introduction to the parable that Caitlin just read for us is told in the opening verses of chapter 15 of the Gospel of Luke. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." And it was in response to that setting that Jesus told three parables, the third one of which goes like this. There was a man who had two sons. Now we should note right from the beginning that the main character of this story is really the father. There was a man who had two sons, Jesus said. But the spotlight shifts now from the primary character to one of the two secondary characters. The younger son said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." Now, pause. Already, we know that this is a story about rudeness. Already, we know that this is a story about self-centeredness. Already, we know that this is a toxic story that Jesus is going to tell. In fact, this story is so toxic, it might even be said that this younger son is treating his father as though his father has already died. According to Jewish law and Jewish custom at this time, when a father owned a farm, presumably in this particular setting, and the estate was due to his sons, that would be done at the time of the father's death. According to Jewish custom, two-thirds would have gone to the older son. One-third of his estate would have gone to the younger son. Now, there were occasions when a father might decide to give the estate to his children, his sons, earlier. And under those circumstances, the father would sell his estate. The father would have rights of survivorship so that the father could continue to live on that property until the time that the father died. But the children would be able to use the income from the sale of the property, and that is the setting here. And so, Jesus tells us, the father divided his property between his sons. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, all of the loot that he had just received from his father, from his share of the estate. He set off for a distant country, and there he squandered his wealth in wild living. Pause for a moment. These are interesting words. In Luke's Greek, in Luke chapter 15, these words, squandered and wild, describe something that is spread unevenly, something that is divided and cast out all over the place. Think for a moment of a river that is running within its boundaries, and then it comes up over its boundaries, and it begins running recklessly all over the land. This is the sort of picture that is being painted by Jesus. He squandered his wealth willy-nilly, here and there, everywhere. There is no organizing principle for where it goes. It's just scattered and squandered all over the place, as though he is divided in 1,000 different ways. He squandered it in wild living, like a wildfire, like a riot. There is no order. There is no direction. It is simply chaotic, wild, and random living. And so, after he had spent everything, every nickel and dime, after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to feed the pigs. Now, the leaving home has reached its fullest distance with this sentence. This is a Jewish boy whose leaving home has now led him to leave custom, tradition, law, wisdom, all of it is gone, as a Jewish boy has now hired himself out to feed the unclean pigs whom the Jews would not have even touched. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. Well, that's it. That's as far as we're going to go today. We're going to stop right here. If you want to hear the rest of the story, you're going to have to come back next week. This is sort of like when you're watching TV and you get to the end of the episode and they say, come back next week for part two. And if you're one of those people, if this drives you crazy, let's just say it was Ben Kreider's idea, okay? We're going to stop right here. And I want to remind you that among those listening to this story were a group of people who at this point had to be getting a little nervous and a little fidgety. The tax collectors and the sinners were among those who were listening to the story at this point. And at this moment in the telling of the story, I imagine the tax collectors and sinners beginning to fidget a little bit in their seats, and they're getting a little bit uncomfortable, and they're probably taking their bulletins and looking down at their bulletins. And they're clearing their throats, and suddenly they have all of them have a cold together. Because it is pretty clear who Jesus is imagining or picturing in the telling of this younger son, and it is not a flattering picture. Notice the plot of the story. It is a very, very complicated plot. Very, very, very complicated. Extremely complicated. Movement number one, the younger son wants it, and he wants it now. Plot move number two, he leaves home. Plot move number three, he lives wildly and recklessly. And plot move number four, what word shall we use for number four? I just can't think of a better one than the father himself will use at a later point in the story, lost. And this is the story of tax collectors and sinners. Whatever picture you have in your mind of tax collectors, wipe that picture out for just a moment. These are not IRS agents who people don't like because they gather the taxes for orderly purposes. Wipe that picture out for just a moment. These are rotten people. These tax collectors are people who had hired themselves out to the Roman government. Most of them sat at the opening of a road that stretched from one town or village to another. And the only rules that governed their behavior were that at the end of the day, they had to have so much money collected from their tolls that they would hand over to the Roman government. That was it. Everything that they raised beyond that was theirs to pocket. It was a system that was absolutely rife for abuse that had been allowed to go on year after year after year. And so if a tax collector was standing at the head at the beginning of the road from Capernaum to Nazareth, and they saw somebody wandering along who looked like a businessman who might have a little bit of money, they'd size them up a little bit, and they'd think, how urgent does he look? And they might say, for you today, $20 to walk this road. And the person walking the road might say, what do you mean $20? Last week it was $5. Sorry, buddy, this week it's $20. If you want to walk the road, it's $20 today. And so if he wanted to do his business, he had to pull out a $20 bill. And this was what tax collectors did. This was a system that was rife for abuse. These aren't people serving an orderly system. These are extortioners who are getting everything that they can to pad their wallets. These are not good people. And these sinners that are listening in, these are not folks that stop at the bar on the way home from work for a couple of beers. These are people who the Jewish nation regarded as the cause of their problems. You see, life was hard. They were living under Roman tyranny and Roman rule, and they wondered, all the time they wondered, what is the cause of our suffering? What is it that has happened that God is displeased with us? And so much of the blame had been thrown on these people who were cavalier about the Jewish law, you know, folks who just kind of went their own way. Does the law say, do not commit adultery? There are more guidelines than laws, really. Does the law say, keep the Sabbath day holy? These were the people who said, do as you please. And many of the Jewish nation regarded them as the reason that God was not blessing their land and blessing their people. And it's these people who are listening to the story that Jesus is telling this morning. And it is not a beautiful story about them. There was a son, wanton living, lost. This is not a comforting story. Those who had discerning ears would have also recognized that Jesus was telling Israel's story. He was telling the story of his own people. He was telling the story of the Jewish people. This people who were chosen by God, they were God's beloved child. And yet they had gone out wanting after all kinds of things, listening to the words of the prophets of the idols of their ages. They had gone out wanting this and wanting that and given themselves to every little want that they had. And it wasn't long until they were leaving home. And I mean, quite literally leaving home. These were the people who were exiled from their homeland to the foreign land of the Babylonians. And these were the people who had lived wildly and recklessly, and these are the people who were absolutely lost. Even at the time of Jesus, many in the Jewish community regarded themselves as still living in exile. Even though they were living in their own homeland, it was under Roman tyranny, and so they still regarded themselves as lost. And so let me go over this very complicated plot that Jesus tells once again. Extraordinarily difficult. Movement number one, want what you want, and want it now. That was the younger son's motto. Movement number two, he left home. Movement number three, he lived wildly and recklessly, scattered all over the place. And movement number four, he was lost. Now, I'd like to tell you a story about lostness. I've told you this story before. In fact, I think Dawn has told you this story as well. I apologize for that. But it really captures this as well as anything that I can think of. Story of lostness. Dawn and I had been married just a little bit over a year, and we decided to go cross-country skiing in the mountains of Wyoming. Now, I had gotten a map from a local sporting goods store, and I'd studied the map over, and the map said that this particular cross-country ski trail was well-marked. It said that. I'm telling you, it said that. So, we drove up into the mountains of Wyoming with the very first snow of fall. And we found the trailhead to this particular cross-country ski trip, and it was marked at the trailhead, and I had a map with me, and so we set out on the easy trail. It was the first time of the year, Dawn's first time cross-country skiing. We figured it would take us about an hour or so to take this easy loop back to the starting point. And we had made our way just a little ways, and there was a fork in this trail, one going this way in the woods and one going this way, and there was no marking. Well, it must be because, you know, the way we're supposed to go here is so obvious. And so we took the one that seemed obvious from the map. We followed the one to the left. And after a while, there was another fork in the trail, and there was no mark. And after a little while, there was another. And, well, what happened was we had gone up before they had marked the trails. We were so early in the season, they had not put the markers up yet. And you all know already what happened, don't you? Yes, she whined. What was intended to be an hour or so simple first cross-country trip of the year turned out to be an entire day. And it was exhausting. And there were points during this ski, well, actually many, many hours, we simply didn't know where we were. The map had come to be meaningless. We'd taken so many turns and twists that we didn't know which way was north. The map was absolutely meaningless. And finally, thanks to my extraordinary intuition and my keen sense of direction, we lucked out and heard a car driving by in the distance, and we followed the sound. I tell you that story because being lost is horrific. Being lost is the most disorienting thing I can imagine. Being lost is frightening beyond words. I was imagining creating a snow cave and thinking about how we were going to try to keep each other warm on a bitterly cold night in the mountains. Being lost is horrid. And I want to give you now a foolproof, absolutely time-tested, proven generation after generation after generation strategy for getting lost. Are you ready? A foolproof strategy for being lost. Number one, want what you want and want it now. Number two, leave home. Number three, live scatterbrained. And number four, well, number four, you have arrived at your non-destination. You are lost. Number one, want what you want and want it now. This is a description of of those of us who have before us thousands and thousands of options of what we can do with the hungers of our lives. And it is a description of those who work selfishly and without patience. That's key. To want what you want and to want it now is key. If you really want to be lost, let me recommend to you, be impatient. That's extraordinarily important. Recognize what it is that you want and then glob onto it now. Don't live with the wanting. Glob now. Number one, want what you want and want it now. Number two, step number two, sure, fireproof method of becoming lost is leave home. And by leaving home now, I of course am speaking symbolically. I'm talking about leave the traditions of wisdom that are part of your life. Leave the time-honored values that have been taught to you and brought to you. Leave the community of wisdom, church, of which you have been a part, and go your own way. This is the way of those who decide that they know better themselves than time-honored ways of tradition would have taught them. This is the way of those who go their own way, if I can borrow the words of Fleetwood Mac, and they leave home. Now, leaving home is also a matter of leaving God, of course. Leaving home is a way of stepping out of the embrace and the welcome of God. It is a way of stepping out of He who provides for us all of the time, and demanding, instead of living in trust in the one who provides for us all the time, it demands that we have it. You understand the difference? There is a way of living in trust in the Father who provides all of the time without demanding to have it. And there's a way of stepping out and saying, no, I want to possess it, whatever it is, wealth or joy or love or goodness. I don't want to just simply receive it all the time. I want to have it. And so it is crucial, if you want to leave home, that you have to leave the confines and the home of your Father. You know how the Bible says that in God we live and move and have our being? Well, if you want to leave home, you have to decide that's a little too constraining. It's just too constraining to live my life in God. I want to live my life outside of God. And so you step out and you decide you're going to live independently, and you're going to own what it is that you want, not just receive it. Do you see the difference? This is important if you want to be lost. The third step, of course, is scattered living. Think of the river again for a moment. The third step is to live in a state of scatteredness. You want to spread yourself out as far and wide as you can, because you see, it might take 10,000 things to make you happy. It might take 100,000 things for you to really be secure. It might take 1,000,000 things for you to have empowerment in your life. And so the goal here, the trick, is to scatter yourself amongst all of them. Ooh, there's an apple I have to have. Oh my goodness, I won't be able to get by without that. You must scatter yourself as broad and wide as you can. In fact, you could even think of yourself as 1,000 different selves if you want to. If you want to be really, truly lost. And I promise you, I absolutely promise you that this works. These four steps to lostness absolutely work. But I need to warn you that lostness looks different for different people. For one person, it looks like that person who is going off to all the parties and is hungover all the time, and they're either drunk or else they're getting over being drunk. For one person, it looks like that. But for another person, lostness looks like, I'm bored. I'm just so bored. I've had this and 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 this. And the truth is, I'm just bored. I've had it all. For some people, lostness looks like, why am I so lonely? I'm surrounded by people, and yet I'm not really connected with anybody. Why is it that I am so strangely lonely? For some people, lostness looks like, I'm just burned out. I've given myself to so many different things. I'm just burned out. I think it looks 1,000 different ways, but of this I'm sure, there are sure-fired and time-tested ways of getting there. Now, I want you to be aware that already, even stopping where we are, there is good news in this story. Even at this juncture, where the younger son is longing to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything, and the good news that is already present in this story is that he is hungry. He's really, really, really hungry. He's arrived at a place in the journey where wanting, impatient wanting, has given way to hunger. You see, there's a difference. There is a wanting what you want and wanting it now. That is our efforts to go out and feed our hungry right away. And we all do it, don't we? That's wanting what you want and wanting it right now. He has arrived at a place where all of that has no longer worked for him. And now this younger son is just hungry. And he's yearning. And he's longing. Have you ever wondered why it was that the tax collectors and the sinners were attracted to Jesus like children to a playground? Have you ever wondered that? Why is it that Jesus, wherever he went, he seemed to have tax collectors and sinners gathering around him? He'd be eating at a table someplace, and there in this intimate setting of fellowship would be tax collectors and sinners. And over here he's teaching, and there are tax collectors and sinners. And over here he's in this and there, and all these places in between, always the gospel writers are telling us, and the tax collectors and the sinners were with Jesus. Have you ever wondered why it was that the sinners and the tax collectors were attracted to Jesus like children to a playground? It wasn't because he was soft on sin. For heaven's sakes, there has been no more challenging preacher in the history of the world than Jesus. Go leave your life of sin. Walk a different way. No. It wasn't because Jesus was soft on sin. The tax collectors and the sinners were attracted to Jesus because they were hungry. They were hungry. They were longing. We would say in our parlance today, they had come to the end of their rope, and they were really, really hungry. Do you remember earlier in the ministry of Jesus, in the Gospel of Matthew, we're told, in the fifth chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, we're told that Jesus gave this sort of extended teaching time that we call the Sermon on the Mount. And gathered around him are all these disciples. He's gathered on the mount. And at the beginning of this, the first 10 verses of the Sermon on the Mount, there's a section that's called the Beatitudes. These are the description of Jesus of the people who are really blessed. He's been looking around at all the crowds and all the people, and now he's going to describe who's really, really, really fortunate in the world and who's really, really, really blessed. And these are some of the people he names. By the way, read them in chapter 5 of Matthew, verses 1 through 10. It's extraordinary, Jesus' definition of who's really, really, really fortunate. Here are a few of them. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. By the way, the Greek says, the word poor is abjectly impoverished. Blessed are those who are spiritually abjectly poor, because they're the ones to whom the kingdom of heaven belongs. Among those who Jesus describes as blessed are, fortunate or blessed are you who mourn the state of the world, who mourn the state of your country, who mourn your own state, because you're the ones who will be comforted. Among those who Jesus identifies as fortunate or blessed are blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. They're so hungry and they're so thirsty and they're so longing for change, the world's change and their own. They are the most fortunate people on the entire planet, Jesus says. Now there's a fascinating little portion of this narrative of the prodigal son that is not immediately obvious. And that is where it is in his life and ministry that Jesus tells this story. Jesus tells the story of the prodigal son while he's on the journey from Galilee to Jerusalem. Luke has said five chapters or so earlier, Luke has said, when the time came for Jesus to ascend to heaven, he resolutely set himself toward Jerusalem. And from this moment in the ministry of Jesus, this moment when he resolutely set himself toward Jerusalem, he begins walking with a single-minded focus. Did you notice? The prodigal is scattered everywhere. Jesus walks with singleness of purpose. And he walks from Galilee toward Jerusalem over these chapters, these middle chapters of the Gospel of Luke. And you know what happens. You know the story. You know that as he walks along this journey, he meets greater and greater and greater adversity as he walks along. And as he stops and he teaches the tax collectors and the sinners and the Pharisees in this setting, there's this extraordinary thundercloud that is approaching him. And Jesus walks and walks with singleness of purpose further and further toward Jerusalem. And you know what happens. You know that when he gets there, the climax of the resistance will take place. And on Friday of what we call Holy Week, Jesus is crucified, dead, and buried by the powers and principalities of our world. And you know the deeper layer of the story. You know that this is the story of our redemption. This is the story of our coming home. This is the story of the Father's embrace of us. This is the story of the party. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Because the good news in this story is it's time to be hungry. Are you hungry today? Are you hungry today? I'm not talking about are you wanting. Wanting is what you do at this level of your life. It's what you do in the first moment that you discover that you're anxious. Wanting is what you do when you say, oh, I'm anxious. Maybe I could fill that with entertainment or food or whatever it may be. Wanting is what you do when you think, I love my neighbor's car. I want to have a car just exactly like that one. And so you set yourself after that car. That's wanting. Wanting takes place at this level right here. And hunger takes place at this level way down here. And the good news of this story is that the prodigal has left wanting. And he's arrived at hungry. Are you hungry today? I want to counsel you to live with your hunger during Lent. Live with it. Don't try to jump away from it. Don't try to run from it. Don't be afraid of it. I want to counsel you to live with your hunger during the season of Lent. You need to know that the culture of which you are a part does not have much of a clue about how to do this. You need to know that the whole culture of which you are a part is about feeding the wants up here at this level right here so that you never arrive down at the deeper levels of hunger. But I want you to know that in the earliest years of the life of the church, the most natural of things took place. The early church, by the end of the first century, as I've told you before, had begun to develop rhythms of worship. It was the most natural thing in the world for people that had come out of the Jewish synagogues to imitate what they had done in the synagogues, seasons of worship, rhythms of the year. And so it was the most natural thing of all. By about the end of the first century, the church had set aside a season of time in which they journeyed very, very, very slowly with Jesus toward the cross. They weren't in any big hurry. They walked slowly along with him. Please notice this. In the Gospels, roughly one-third of the story of the Gospels is dedicated to the last week of the ministry of Jesus. I think we're intended to slow down during this time. And so the early church slowed down and they walked slowly with Jesus on the journey toward the cross. And in their wisdom, one of the things that the early church did is they listened to their hunger. They listened to it. Not afraid of it. Not running from it. They listened to it. There are two or three really important things that happen as we learn to listen to our hunger. First of all, when you observe yourself, when you're anxious, lonely, afraid, when you just observe it without judging, when you just listen to your own hungering, you discover that it doesn't kill you. What do you know? I'm feeling lonely in this particular moment, and loneliness is not killing me. I must have all the resources that I need right here and right now to deal with loneliness because I don't have to run off and feed it at this level. I can live with it, and it's not killing me. It's a wonderful gift to realize that your hungers don't kill you. The second thing that happens when you begin to observe and listen to your hungers is that you disarm some of their negative power. When you realize that it doesn't kill you, it disarms some of its negative power to make you run off into the distant lands and do all of those nasty, silly things. And the third thing that can happen when you listen to your hunger is it will lead you home. It will turn your face from this direction in which you have been walking, and it will turn your face in this direction, and you begin to face home. And you may not even know it yet, but there is a party that is waiting at the end of that road that is unlike any party that you've ever met before. I hope that it's clear this morning that I am speaking to people who are not yet even believers. If you're not yet even a believer, I hope that you'll listen to your hunger and let it help you to begin to turn home. But I'm also speaking to this morning to people who've been believers in Jesus for 70 or 80 years. Because we've all hopped off on the journey toward the far land. We've all gone grabbing after our million wants. We've all journeyed in 1,000 scattered different directions. We've all squandered and pilfered and plundered. And the gift of Lent is we're invited back to listen to our hunger and let it help us to turn home. And as we do, we will go home more deeply and more profoundly and more thoroughly than we have before. A writer by the name of Howard Friend tells about a little fish that a friend of his owned, a little fish named Harvey that lived in its little aquarium. And Harvey the fish just swam around in circles all day long. This is all he ever did. He just swam around and around and around and around. And one day this friend needed to clean out the fishbowl. So he filled up the bathtub with water and he got the temperature just right in the bathtub and he took the little net, took Harvey out of there and stuck Harvey down into the bathtub water and went to clean out this little fishbowl. And when he came back, you'll never guess what he saw Harvey doing. In exact same dimensions, he saw Harvey, who now had a great big bathtub. He's now saw Harvey swimming around and around and around and around and around. And how like Harvey we all are. The same ruts, the same places, again and again and again. The same circle, even though there are extraordinary possibilities for us, we're just here. And Lent is an invitation to step out of here. It's an invitation to listen to your longings. And it's an invitation to let your longings lead you to the heart of God, because this is a journey in love. Jennifer, would you come and lead us in worship? And I want you to know that the altar is open this morning. If any of you wish to come and pray as we sing together, you are welcome to this altar at this time.